Larry Kleinman, welcome again to KABU.
Always a pleasure to chat with you.
Larry co-founded with Cipriano Farrell and joined by Roman Ramirez to lead the organization Picun. Picun, in its 45 years in Woodburn, Oregon, had many successes, became a formidable farm worker union, won several strikes for higher pay, work safety, pesticide control, won eligibility for driver's license for undocumented people, and made Oregon a sanctuary state, the first state in the nation to pass a statewide law stopping state and local police and government from helping federal authorities with immigration enforcement. So, Larry, let's start with concentration camps. There was a separation of families. Babies were taken from their mothers and all kids and put into some miserable concentration camps. One of Trump's efforts to stop the immigrants, or maybe Stephen Miller's, Trump sort of doesn't make policy, he just bellows. In any event, that did not work. Explain why.
Well, fundamentally, two things. One, they got sued successfully by immigrant litigators, pro-immigrant litigators, because there were obligations in place dating back to the 90s of standards that the federal government had undertaken to adhere to for the treatment of minors, unaccompanied minors, but minors in general. And secondly, they didn't begin to have the capacity to actually do it. Now, that said, they separated, there's something like 10,000 cases, something like that, that when Biden took office, of families where they were still seeking to figure out how to reunite those families. And many, I would say most of those have now been accomplished, even if it took a while. The damage emotionally, of course, is there and will be there for a lifetime. Hopefully those families will be able to cope with that as best they can. But that number is dramatically reduced. And the Biden administration ended that policy, though there are still some examples where I think the simple logistics have challenged them utterly. Again, as the cartels move people around, probing for weak spots or opportunities. And another thing I want to stress to you and to the audience, Bill, is that in previous decades, the paradigm of undocumented immigration mostly involved people attempting to cross the border and arrive in the interior without being detected. The paradigm in the last 3 years, and even before that, during the Trump years, was folks seeking political asylum. So they would come to the border and look for the first Border Patrol agent they could find to surrender in order to make that application. And so it's a completely different, I mean, the other kinds of human trafficking is going on, don't get me wrong, but the bulk of the folks who have entered have voluntarily surrendered, even sought that in order to make that application. And so the big strain on the system, exacerbated by manipulation by folks like Governor Abbott of Texas, has been how to handle those numbers, how to build the facilities, the staffing, the social support, et cetera, you know, the bureaucratic process in order to process that numbers of folks. And where there are now presently more than 2 million cases pending in the immigration court system, which will take years and years to sort through.
Yeah. And in the meantime, the people have papers that allow them to stay in the country.
Well, yes and no. They have a... Because they're under proceedings, they can't be arrested and deported as long as they fulfill whatever those conditions are of release. But getting a work permit is also something that is part of a political asylum process, assuming they can pass what's called a well-founded fear interview. But the simple processing of that request for the work permit has taken months and months, even years, which is another one of those systemic pains that then hobbles both the immigrants and the communities that receive them. And that's, of course, exacerbated by the political manipulation of Abbott using Texas tax dollars, hundreds of millions of Texas tax dollars, to dispatch buses loaded with immigrants with recent arrivals to Chicago, New York, DC, Denver, and other places with no regard to what the welfare of those folks are or the readiness of those communities, but simply to make the political point. So it's human suffering in aid of making the political point that the infrastructure is not in place or readied in the right places to receive people, even though the state of Texas, of course, could have invested that money instead in receiving people and helping them on their way to become the workers that our society actually needs to be prosperous.
Yeah, the one final effort to stop the immigration that did not work was the right-wing effort to impose on employers the duty to check for undocumented workers and then, I guess, report them to the ICE. My sense is that businessmen made a quite determined demand on their senators and on their congresspeople not to force them to do that. They wanted, especially in the slaughterhouse industry and in agriculture, in nursing homes, in restaurants, they needed those undocumented workers. That business stopped those efforts to force them to check the, is that right?
That's a hard, I'm not sure that there's a clear line. Clearly, that's what they wanted, and that one must believe, given their influence, that that has had influence. I got to say that the business community in the immigration space, which had assumed or maybe even became accustomed to exerting that influence in a powerful way, has really been greatly curtailed as the MAGA forces have completely taken over the Republican Party. So, for example, we believed 10 years ago, and we were almost right, I'll just say, we were almost successful, that an alliance, a negotiated arrangement between management and labor, broadly speaking, U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO, in the broader labor world, and between the growers and United Farm Workers and PECUN and other farm worker unions, we negotiated language for admitting workers with a workplace protections, with the right to organize, the right to legal services, with the right to a path to citizenship or to permanence. So it had the support of both sides. And I'm talking about the 2013-2014 legislation. It passed the Senate. It bogged down in the House as the Tea Party put a stop to it. Passing that legislation today is unthinkable because of the complete collapse of support for it on the Republican side. And yet the same business interests, they're just as powerful as ever, near as I can tell, and yet they have no traction with their own, with the forces that are nominally their party or their historic party. And that the only way, Bill, that we could pass such a bill, which is deeply deserved, to achieve that permanence for folks that have been here decades in some cases, would be if Biden wins re-election, the Democrats take the House of Representatives, even if narrowly, they hold the Senate, only losing Manchin's seat, which I'm sure they're going to lose, but he wasn't a friend of ours anyway on this. So it's a 50-50 Senate, and they get rid of the filibuster. That's what it would take. It would take those four things in order to pass this. Any other pathway is, at this point, seems politically unthinkable, despite what you would imagine is the immense pressure and sway of big business, of business writ large.
Hi, folks. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour every Monday at 9 a.m. on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Our variety, of course, it's in the struggles from below that we cover. I'm talking to Larry Kleinman, one of the founders of PECUN, the Farm Workers and Tree Planters Organization, sometimes known as a union because they've often gone on strike for decent work and pay. So far, we've covered in the great in-migration, why people from around the world are coming to the U.S. and U.S. North America, and how the efforts to stop them have failed. In the next segment, we're going to discuss the human story and the development of PECUN and Woodburn as a city. So, Larry, you've been in Willamette Valley for near 50 years. You've seen a lot, written a lot, lots of op-eds, lots of descriptions of struggles and what the movement learned from them, lots of pictures of life in the fields of Oregon. You've seen several generations of families, many who came here from traditional rural communities all over Central and some South American countries, who not only did not speak more than a few words of English, but never went to school, also did not know Spanish, maybe an indigenous language, and may have started unable to sign their name. Their development, their tenacity speaks to their determination and the vast capacities of the human mind and body. I always like to say we are all ordinary folks of an extraordinary species. Give us a sense of how the immigrants of Woodburn and the Valley have endured and made rich lives. Though, to be sure, some have failed. Some stay here to accumulate money to build a home and farm in their birthplace. Others have become stuck at the bottoms of society. Tell us that story, though, the human story that in the beginning of this interview, you discussed how this in-migration is very much like the white people's in-migration from Europe in 19th and 20th centuries. Tell us the story, the human story.
Well, like I said in the previous conversation, it is a common pattern in U.S. immigration. And I think the roots of it actually, people may ask, well, why did folks come to Oregon? And the key driver was the Bracero program, a program started in the early years of World War II when there was a sudden need for workers in agriculture, especially in the West, because the previous workers that had been in that industry went into war industry or went to war. Many of them were Dust Bowl refugees in the 30s coming to the West Coast. So they brought in train loads of workers from Mexico. That program ended in the early 60s, but the sort of ties of connection of employment, of opportunity were already established. So it's not an accident that many of the folks who settled in Oregon came from the regions, you know, in Mexico, the state of Michoacán, for example, in central Mexico, that were the original places of residence of those Bracero workers. There have been many waves of folks that have come later in the 80s, many folks from Oaxaca and especially from indigenous communities. And today, the wave that we're seeing arriving in Woodburn are largely folks from Guatemala who are coming because of the three forces that I mentioned in our previous conversation: climate change impacting Guatemala very significantly, cartel violence, and the crushing economics. So in the last, 5 years, at least a couple of thousand folks from Guatemala have settled in Woodburn, which is the first appreciably, you know, or sizable population of Latinos who are not Mexican or Mexican descent. But Woodburn is a community that's long had a Mexican majority. It's increasingly a mixed status, meaning many more folks of Mexican descent who are citizens, born here, the children or grandchildren of immigrants, many of the immigrants of the previous generation having legalized and become citizens through the 1986 immigration law, which we helped 1,300 folks gained status at that time. They then brought families. So the similar pattern that we've seen in other periods of our country's history have been played out yet again. And they have changed the character of their community and of the society more broadly. Today, there are more than 600,000 Latinos in the state, something like 12% of the population. And the first grade class across the state is probably twice that, so 25%. So that's the demographic trend that we see. And again, like other waves of immigration from other places, my own family, and perhaps yours as well, Bill, included, we see played out the striving for stability, which I believe is one of the fundamental obligations of our movement, help build stability in various ways. We've also seen the beauty, but also the limits of solidarity across immigrant communities and within immigrant communities, within groups of workers. We've seen the next generation composed of a greater percentage of folks who gain professional status, who become small business owners, and whose class identification actually transforms or evolves accordingly. Again, in a way that's very similar to other generations. One last thing I'd say is that the one phenomenon in the last 10 years is we've seen a higher proportion within the flow of immigrants from all over the world arriving here that are from professional classes in their country. And I think that is a particularly strong indicator of the effects of cartel violence. And there are places in the world, in Latin America in particular, where folks historically have had a perfectly reasonable or manageable life, economically or socially, who literally cannot stay in their community anymore because the threat of violence is a daily matter. And so we're seeing increasing numbers of folks coming. But again, that only ends up strengthening our society. Our country, notwithstanding Donald Trump's famous lie, one of his many famous lies, our country is not full, as he declared one day in Yuma when he visited there. But our politics are full. It feels like our politics are full, driven by race and xenophobia and other forms of insecurity that are associated with immigration.
Larry, we'll talk soon on the future. Thanks so much for talking to us today, and we'll talk to you soon about the whole set of interesting issues in the future of America and its immigrants, including if Trump wins, and long-term solutions, the path to citizenship, how U.S. foreign policy, if it's changed, to actually support reform groups in Central and South America, and how to win continued support for immigration amongst people who have been convinced that immigrants are hurting the community. And also, you pointed out how to keep the immigrant communities on a solidaristic politics rather than an upward mobility politics and competitiveness that business fosters. That seems to me a challenge for the left. And how do we deal with climate change? All those issues are open. Larry Kleinman has lots of experience in working on them. Thanks for talking to us today.
Appreciate the invitation, Bill. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care, Bill.
You too.